Hello and welcome to our meeting of the Board of County Commissioners. As usual, we will begin by looking to those in attendance for a volunteer to lead us in the prayer, reading, or thought, and the Pledge of Allegiance. Do we have any volunteers? Okay, I'll share a thought. Anyone to lead us in the pledge? Okay, there's someone in the back, actually. Great. I guess here's a quick thought that I'll read from John Adams. Posterity, you will never know how much it costs the present generation to preserve your freedom. I hope you will make good use of it. If you do not, I shall repent in heaven that I ever took half the pains to preserve it. And I'm just going to leave it at that. You want to come on up to the podium? Please.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you. Okay, we'll go through the process of building our agenda. We have 45 published or items on our consent agenda and 8 items on our regular agenda. Anything that we pull off or everything that we do not discuss will automatically be approved on consent unless we hold it for discussion. The first item, I just have a quick conversation, is 12. Anyone have
12?
Anything before then?
Nope.
Okay. Hold number 12. And then I go all the way to 42, which we need to strike. And Gary, don't get too concerned about that. Your staffing positions, there's 2 different items. So
43.
Striking
43.
You know, I don't know what version you have. The most recent is 42.
I have 42, it's Gary's too.
Yeah.
Oh. Okay.
Okay. Anything else on consent?
Yeah, quick question on number 19, since it looks like we're working off. This is the one with the Sherwood Landscaping Company?
Yep, I still have that.
As 19?
Yeah.
Okay. And then just a quick question on 21 and then 23. Now, 21 is the Springville one.
Yep.
23... is the one with the event permit, the
yep.
application. Okay.
Okay.
29 is the
votes.
Pilot.
Okay.
And then I'm going to ask that we continue 38 for till our next meeting. I'm working through some thoughts there, some issues. We could continue that for 2 weeks or till our next meeting. That's all I have on consent.
Okay. I am certainly fine to continue that item. I'm curious. We did get through a work session. I don't know if there's any if we haven't begun to post these for hiring, is there any absolute timeliness on this? Okay. All right, we can continue that.
And then I have, just for purposes of, I have 45, which we wrote it in there, and that one's to approve the Qualtrics notice.
So now that's actually in mine.
Oh, got it. Okay, so that's where the numbering got.
Yeah, I think so.
Okay, we just it's handwritten. Okay.
Okay. Let's turn to number 12.
Should we do regular?
Oh, okay. And we're going to go to regular. I think we hold number one.
Mm-hmm. We hold number two as well.
Hold number two. Okay, so we are now only going to discuss those items that have been held. And so I guess I will pause for a moment here and say, is there anyone here that would like to make a public comment on something that we did not hold for discussion? Okay, so we'll turn to number 12 on the consent agenda.
Morning, Commissioners.
Good afternoon.
I've got two items, but go ahead.
I have a question on, there was one of these items where the applicant said, I think it was the Bromley application?
Yes.
Where the applicant said that they did process something online, and it wasn't clear to me whether the county agreed with that or had any evidence of an attempted process online.
Let me see. With Bromley, there was two that both tried to process it. I think this one, yes, so they processed it through our website. And so what will happen is that there's a spot for them to enter in their email address. And then if there's an issue, it'll come back to their email, letting them know that there's been a problem with their account number. Unfortunately, in this circumstance, they didn't put in an email address. They had put their account number and routing information in incorrectly. So when it came through, we tried to process it. It didn't go through, but there was no way for us to respond immediately back. And so our assessor's office then printed out a paper notice, mailed it, and by the time that they received it, it was already too late.
But we do have evidence of the attempted process.
Yes.
Okay. And this is like, I think, under $50 of penalty?
Yes. I think it's $27 in penalty.
Given that we know that they tried to process it, I would certainly entertain forgiving the penalty.
Penalties and interest.
Yeah, I feel the same way.
I feel the same.
And I had a conversation with our treasurer's office to see if there's a way maybe we can make it. That's a required field in the future, so that way we don't have another situation like that happening again.
Okay.
The second one, is that it?
Yeah, that's
it. Okay. The second one is American Fork Industrial Park. I don't know if they're here. Is there somebody here from that? Okay. I don't have a question then.
All right.
Okay. Okay, I'll entertain a motion on number 12. Noting that I think that what we all mentioned was the opposite of what was recommended.
So. I'll make a motion that we approve the property tax actions as contained in number 12 on our published consent agenda, noting that the one with the Sandra and Kirsten Bromley, the penalty and fees that are 27-12 are waived.
Second.
Got a motion and a second to approve number 12 as stated. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. That passes 3-0. Okay, number 19.
This is a quick one. I put a note on the agenda system. I don't know if you saw it or not.
I have. I've been up at the conference the last couple of days.
Is this is this agreement that we're agreeing to the tree that was taken down?
Yes.
It's already been done?
Yes.
Already taken down?
Yep. We were under the understanding because of the cost limit that we were good beforehand, and when we got to payment, it's like, okay, we need to have a contract on this, so we're playing catch up on this one.
Okay.
But this is the one that was taken down north of the courthouse.
Yeah. I prefer not to do this way, but
I would agree with it. We thought we were within the rules, and we goofed on it, so.
Okay. Done. It's well done. It was right outside my window, so I watched it. I saw Tom do it.
They didn't break the window.
They didn't break
any
windows.
That's good.
Yeah. All right.
Okay. I'd entertain a motion on 19.
I'll make a motion that we approve number 19 on our published consent agenda.
Second.
Motion and a second. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. That passes 3-0. Item 21.
Item 21. I know we've worked this through back and forth, and I believe this one has the latest version that came last night.
The one that was uploaded last night.
The one that was uploaded. So I want to make sure that latest version was the one that we're considering here.
Yes, that is correct.
Okay. So if it's adopted and the resolution is that latest version that was uploaded, the only other question I have is do we know if this went through COG?
Yes, it did.
Okay.
It was done through COG. And
it was questionable last time we talked.
It was on
the
approval list that the county commission approved. I believe it was last August, or I couldn't tell you exactly the date, but it's on the list that you've already previously approved.
Very good. All right.
And just to clarify, I mean, I actually didn't see that on the agenda system. I saw it come through via the email.
Yeah.
But just so that we know what we're voting on, I agree. The major change is that we're voting on one that does not include the corridor preservation.
Correct.
Right. Yeah.
And those are the same. The email that was sent by my assistant and what was uploaded by me are the same document.
Yep. Okay.
Yeah. Okay. Want a motion? I'll make a motion that we adopt the resolution authorizing the commissioner to sign the agreement, interlocal agreement, as stated in number 21, noting it's with the latest version that we've all agreed to.
That doesn't have the corridor.
I've seen.
That does not have the corridor preservation.
That does not have it, yes. Very good note. Yes.
Second.
We have a motion and a second to approve item number 21 as stated. All in favor say aye.
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 That passes 3-0. 23.
Okay, on number 23, I'm wondering if we shouldn't go through the process and get the application and everything amended or changed, because as I look down through the application, and I can get there, if you look under the attachment A, it says, and this was filled out for an athletic event and outdoor entertainment. And it says that the plans for providing toilets and lavatory facilities included the source, number of locations, types, and means of disposable of waste. And they put on that the guests will use the lavatory facilities on site. And then the second one, number 6, says the plans for holding, collecting, and disposing of solid waste materials. And the answer was guests will use the lavatory facilities on site. If we go down and look at our criteria on here, of course, we don't want them bagging up their garbage and putting it in the toilets.
Correct.
But that's what they have on their application. And then the second one, we have on their applicant shall provide toilet facilities for the event. Applicant and event participants are not permitted access, which they signed at the bottom that they'd agree to, but it's not clear in something that we're accepting
as an
application.
And I think there may have been a little bit of a miscommunication on what they were asking for in their application. The park that they are using, Olympic Park, is a Lehigh City facility. They will be using the facilities at that park. What they're asking for and what their event permit is actually just for the use of the Jordan River Trail for the race itself.
Okay.
So there are no facilities along the portion of the trail that they'll be using.
Okay. So that's actually not applicable then?
Correct.
Those two that were?
Yes, because they will be in the Lehigh City park that they will have their starting and ending at. Olympic Park there. So, I believe it's just south of 2100 North.
All right. And then, so kind of noting that those two are not really applicable.
And then we can make a note on the application.
Make a note on that.
According to that. So
the second question, or the third question I have is, it deals with insurance. Have we verified insurance?
I don't know if we have or not. I know that's something that, Jamie works through the attorney's office, and they look at that prior to issuing any of these permits. So
yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah, and just for clarification, the only item on the agenda today is the fee waiver. If the fee is waived or not waived, it still would have to go through the process to finalize the event permit.
And I believe Adam is the one working on it currently, isn't he? That's from your office.
Right. Including the sign-off verification for insurance.
So we could go ahead and approve this with the notation that, you know, that it, that those two are not applicable and that there will be a verification of insurance.
Yeah, because you're only approving the fee waiver or denying it today, not the event permit.
Right.
That doesn't come before the commissioners. That's just a routine.
I see what you're saying. Okay.
That we normally process.
Okay. It's just that down at the bottom, when it says, in one of the documents that was sent to us, that had been verified, that the insurance was intact and that it was being signed off as a verification.
And that's probably one of the standard forms that's on there. So
yeah.
Yep.
So I assume when it's on here that we're verifying insurance.
Yeah, before the permit is issued, it is all verified. So.
Okay.
Okay.
Just for clarification, though, with regard to item 23, if it's approved, I just need to clarify that it's approved. The wording of it says approve or deny. So just in the motion, clarify what you're doing.
Okay, that's all the questions I have.
Okay. So what are you thinking, that we want to approve the fee waiver and not grant a permit until they fix some of your concerns? Do we want to continue this? What do we?
I think that I'm satisfied that all we're doing is the fee waiver on this thing.
Correct.
The application they have, the parts that they filled out are really null and void. It doesn't matter.
Yep.
Because it doesn't apply to us.
Yeah.
So I'm fine with
Lehigh City Park.
With where we're at.
And the insurance before
and the insurance will have
issue
to be
the permit, anyway. Then they have to have that. So.
Okay.
Yeah.
I move then that we approve consent agenda item number 23.
And I'll second that. Can I add to it that it's the waiver is contributes to the health and moral well being of the county inhabitants? Is that
I think friendly?
Dave usually looks for that.
Great. Okay, we got a motion and a second to approve number 23 as stated. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. That passes 3-0. Item 29.
Okay, item 29. This one's for a process, and I have a lot of questions on it. I think any attempt that we're making to allow individuals the most opportunities to vote is recommended. You know, we should do that. The concern that I have is that this one, I just don't know the answers to it, and I see some concerns out there. MIT research identified security vulnerabilities in the voting app that we're talking about, and they wrote a whole paper on it, listing it. I don't know if I want to read down through it, but they do have some concerns, and so I'm just wondering, have you read down through that, and can you address it, Josh, so that I'd like to submit this just for the record.
Sure.
That it's being submitted. Because when I read down through that from MIT, it gives me pause.
Yeah, yeah. So our office was notified by the actual software provider prior to the report coming out. And we could go into kind of a lot of detail about, you know, who that report really is by and what motivated it and how it was done. But we've been in touch with the software provider. We've been in touch with the Department of Homeland Security. And also the researchers. We've reviewed the report in its entirety. And in short, you have essentially a group of people that do not believe that anybody should ever vote in any way, shape, or form electronically and over the internet. And that is their ideological, philosophical position. And that motivated them to then go after this software and try and identify weaknesses. Well, what they did in this particular study is they took a version of the app that is 27 versions old, so it's not the current version of the app that we would be using or that's currently deployed for active elections. And they then attempted to try and identify weaknesses. One of the things that they weren't able to do is connect to the actual server that serves the entire process of voting. So they, in their laboratory, they basically made up a guesstimate of what they think the server might do. So then they took this old version of the app. They then reconfigured the app to communicate to a server that is not a replication of the real system. And then they tried to identify weaknesses. I mean, I could go through in detail the nature of the weaknesses that they believe they identified, but as we've examined those, talked to the provider, talked to the Department of Homeland Security, talked to other jurisdictions who are using this app, we are persuaded that none of the weaknesses that they've identified are real weaknesses that would actually undermine in any way our use of the app or any votes that are cast using the app by voters in our jurisdiction that are overseas or disabled that might be using the system. So we're pretty comfortable with it. We think it's a great solution. I think any time that you have technology and you have concerns about weaknesses in that technology, you have to analyze what's the alternative. And currently the alternative for these particular voters, under state and federal law, they are permitted to submit their votes to us through the traditional paper means, but for overseas citizens, the problem is that because they're overseas, we may not be able to get their absentee ballot to them with enough time for them to vote and send it back. And so federal law creates an opportunity for them to email it back or to fax it back or to use other electronic means as provided by the jurisdiction, which is what this app falls under. So currently, we look at this application and we say, is it better than these alternative means? Is it better than email? Well, you know, email can be hacked, and you know, you're talking about somebody sending their ballot via AOL or Yahoo or something like that, right? So that's a current option that people have. This is an option that's even better and even more secure. It's probably the case that never is a system going to be perfect. You could play imaginary, you know, games all day. We could have a black helicopter land on the top of this building, and they could, you know, break into the basement and, you know, hack our election by physically taking over our ballot center. That those kinds of things are always possible, theoretically. This particular app, though, as we've examined it, we feel it's better than email, and we want to continue to offer it as an option for the overseas voters. So that's kind of where we're at with it.
So what?
Go ahead. Just a quick clarification. All right.
Go ahead.
So just for clarification, this is an option that voters can opt into.
That's correct.
This isn't something that you're forcing everybody to participate with.
That's right.
If they wanted to go with the traditional paper ballot, because
right.
as an individual, you felt that was a more secure voting method and you're
exactly.
leery of this for whatever reason, you could still opt for the paper route.
Yes, that's
so
true.
We're not forcing anybody to participate using this app. It's
that's
completely
right.
optional.
Yeah.
Which
and
I know you were referring to this, but... And even that population that might choose is just the overseas
just
and
the
disabled
overseas.
Voters.
Right.
Right.
Those are the only ones eligible. So, yeah, the federal law is called UACAVA, which stands for Uniformed Overseas Citizens and Voting Rights Act. And basically, if you are a citizen of the United States and you live here and you're eligible to vote, but you're temporarily overseas, whether it's military assignment or some other reason, you still have the right to vote in your home jurisdiction. And then federal law creates some flexibility for states to facilitate your right to vote, even though that communication might be difficult because you're overseas. And so that's where this app becomes an option for voters to submit their ballot back to us. One of the features of this app is that, yes, it's a digital interface for the voter. They submit their vote digitally on their phone, but then our office produces a paper ballot that is a record of that vote, and then that paper ballot is processed along with all the other paper ballots. And we actually have an audit trail for these types of votes so that after the election, we can match the paper ballots we've received to the receipts that were issued to voters, and there's also a blockchain element to it. So there's a really great way to audit and verify that the votes that were cast by voters were received and received correctly and were tabulated as part of our results. So, I mean, it's a really good system, and there are people who don't like it, and they oppose it, and they're activists, and they're out there in the community, in the country, and so they're kind of looking to, you know, criticize it, and that's going to happen. That's going to continue. I don't expect that to let up, but as we've evaluated, as what we think with our citizens who are overseas or disabled, it's a great option.
Okay, so I'm just. I don't live in the IT world, sure. And so many things happen that I don't. But I know that our voting system is one that we got to keep as clean and pure as possible. Yep. And it's been great for me in the past to be able to say, you know, our voting process never touches the internet.
Right.
We can't say that with this though, because it's going to have to.
We never could before, because right. Email. Voters would always be able to email, and in fact, that was the preferred method until we offered this, where, you know, if you're in the military and you're stationed overseas and you want to vote, you would email your vote.
Right.
So
yeah. So help me with the process then. If this app is used, is there a way or an ability? I mean, because we're trying to keep everyone's vote secret, right? Mm-hmm. It's theirs.
Right.
And so walk me through the process of how you take it off this app. And then integrate it into you. So I heard you say you print out a paper ballot for it, yeah. So you have kind of a chain of custody. That's or whatever right. through yeah, the whole process.
Exactly.
But how do you what's the touch points into our system? And I'll preface it with this. What about Trojans or piggybacks or anything like that all of a sudden come in, and then once they're in, they can do something different with our election process?
So our election system here in the building that where we process ballots is not connected to the internet.
Right.
It is, you know, physically firewalled from the internet. There is no connection to the outside internet or even to the network of the county. What we do with every vote that comes into our office, and typically they come right in an envelope physically, we take paper ballots and we scan them on scanners, and the scanners then tabulate the vote, and our inside system, not, you know, connected to the internet, will create those final election results. In the case of these votes, we receive an email, or we have like a login, and it's separate from our election system. This is just at our computers normally. We have access to the server where these votes from these voters are being delivered to us, and we print them on paper ballots. And after we print them on paper ballots, we verify that they match up with the electronic records. And we now have paper ballots that have been delivered to us digitally, not through envelopes. And then we take those paper ballots and we also scan them, and they are then tabulated with the other results. So there's nothing about this system that is digitally or electronically connected to any of our other systems.
Okay. So the separation,
electronic delivery method, essentially.
The separation, like with the paper ballots that come in, first you run it through and it checks the signature that it's correct, and then all of a sudden they separate and go one way and the other way.
That's right.
And so you don't know what the vote goes one correct. Way and the signature goes
correct.
The other way.
That's right.
Same thing happens with this coming in. Is
yes.
There's a separation?
There's a separation. The way this works is the voter with their own app and their interface. They are giving their information, they're verifying their identity, they're being assigned kind of an encrypted personal serial key, if you will. They then are casting their vote, and they're digitally essentially sending that vote to our server. What our server receives is it receives a vote accompanied with a non-personally identifiable serial number. And so we know we can match the serial numbers to the system and say that bona fide voters, we don't know which voters match which serial numbers, so the ballot is anonymous in that sense.
Yeah.
But we're receiving ballots for each of those serial numbers, and you know, all of that's tracked, and in fact the ballot retains that serial number. We have a whole process with the online system where we're verifying that those voters who have signed up to use it are registered voters that are eligible to vote, and that they're receiving the right ballot. And their identity is verified through the system. And then once they're verified, they've cast their vote, we then have ballots. And when those ballots have been delivered in that digital sense, we print them off, we scan them. So it's very much similar to the physical process. It's just sort of happening digitally. But there are paper ballots that then are put into our system with the rest of the process.
And if I capture the serial number on my own, that's one way that I can verify that my
exactly.
vote was counted.
That's right.
And I think that's important. Most people don't know that.
Right.
But that is a way that I can go back and say serial number
exactly.
whatever was actually
that's
counted
right.
on the ballot.
Yeah, the voter will know their own serial
right.
number. And we will know that a vote matches a serial number.
Right.
We won't know who had that serial number.
Correct.
And so it's yeah. really great for voters because they can actually verify that their vote was received by our office and tabulated correctly, which is an added feature that our traditional system doesn't have.
Yeah.
So
I just want to, With these, especially new things, I think Utah and Oregon and Denver or whatever are pretty new in this. Right. And I mean, the election process is important enough to our form of government that I think high scrutiny all the way through. Right. And it sounds from, yep. I just wanted to ask you those questions because they need to be asked for,
yep.
For clarifying purposes.
Exactly. No, excellent questions. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. I'll entertain a motion on that item.
I'll make a motion that we approve and authorize the Commissioner Sayre to sign the Memorandum of Understanding as stated in number 29 on our published consent agenda.
Second.
We have a motion and a second. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. That passes 3-0. Okay, move to regular agenda item number 1. Commissioner Ivey.
You bet. So thank you. I appreciate the opportunity to talk about this what I believe is a very important issue in our community, in our country specifically. I definitely want to thank our good sheriff, Sheriff Smith. He came to me might have been a month ago now, talking about our opportunities to take some action here in Utah County to protect our Second Amendment rights and what we could potentially do. And during the course of that time, I've had the opportunity to meet with several leaders within the gun community to talk about this resolution and their efforts. And as a result, we were able to draft this resolution, which I think very strongly protects the citizens of Utah County, in particular with their Second Amendment rights. As a gun owner myself, I'm proud to be a lifetime member of the NRA. And more than that, I'm proud to be from a generation of Americans, because if you go way back in my family line, I have a great-grandfather who talked about his favorite childhood memories being sitting on the porch in North Carolina and listening to his grandpa talk about the Revolutionary War and the use of his musket to defend his family and fight for freedom. And so that type of heritage lives here today in America, a heritage of protecting individual liberties. And that is embodied in our Constitution and in the Bill of Rights. And I don't think it was by accident that the founders of this great nation put the right to keep and bear arms as the number 2 on that list of inalienable rights. And recently in our country, we've seen some cultural shifts. And that cultural shift has been to look to government to keep us safe, to look outside of our own capacities, and in so doing, to rob honest, good, reputable people of their rights. And as an elected official, that is just something that I will personally not stand for. We have God-given rights in this country, inalienable rights, and among those is the right to keep and bear arms. And as we see government entities in Virginia, at the national level, and even some legislation here in Utah that I believe leads us down a slippery slope, I think it's time that we take a stand in this county, and that we say in Utah County we believe in the Constitution. We believe in a person's right to keep and bear arms, and if entities outside of us act, we're going to take the appropriate measures and responses here in Utah County to ensure that our rights are protected, and that an outside forces cannot come and rob us of what God has given. And that's, the heart and root of why I'm putting this forward today, because I believe in the Second Amendment, and I believe in responsible citizenry's right to keep and bear arms. And that's not just because I'm a hunter. It's because I'm a father and someone who believes that we have to protect ourselves.
If I could, and thank you, and Commissioner Ivey, thank you for putting this on there. It always is interesting. We had a kind of a parallel course in working on this issue, and so when I saw this go up there, I read down through it, and it echoes a lot of the things that I was looking at as well. There's one in here. If you look under the now therefore's number 3, is an important one to me, and it says that the Board of County Commissioners hereby declares its opposition to unconstitutional restrictions on the right to bear arms and intends to oppose, within the limits of the Constitution of the United States and the State of Utah, any efforts to unconstitutionally restrict such rights and to use such legal means as at its disposal to preserve the constitutionally protected right of the citizens to keep and bear arms. I find that one therefore there a very strong one. And I applaud that one being in there. I was going down that same path in a lot of ways looking at that. But I wanted to tell a short story about a lady years ago that she was from Texas. And in Texas at the time, the right to carry her firearm, she could not put it in her purse. That was against the law. She went out to lunch with her parents. They were sitting in a mall at lunch, and a crazy guy came in and started shooting up the place. And first thing she did is she reached for her purse, but she'd already put it in the glove box in her car. It was unfortunate. And she had this gun in the glove box, and she realized she had done that. And they, of course, barricaded and hid. And unfortunately, what happened when she tried to run to escape, and her parents as well, both her parents were killed in that, and she escaped out the window. And she was testifying before Congress at this time, talking about this situation. And I found her story compelling in many ways because, and I'm going to try to quote from her as much as possible. I'll paraphrase some of the things that she said. And she said, "This the Second Amendment is it does have ties onto hunting, the right to have the arms, but that's not really its primary purpose. And the second part, when we're talking about defense and defending ourselves, and that's great too. But we're never going to be able to protect ourselves completely from anybody, from crazies. That's just going to happen. I mean, we're not the timing and everything. And so the third part that she said was just fascinating to me." Because she's sitting there before these congressmen that are sitting up on this stand, and she says, the reason why we have the Second Amendment is to protect us from you, talking about the government. And I think that that is very powerful, because to me, the Second Amendment helps to keep us free from the oppressors that are around us and even the oppressors that possibly could be among us. But I think the Second Amendment there is there for us to stand. And so I've always been a strong defender of the Second Amendment. There are some individuals here that have come into my office, and we've talked about this, over the last little while about the Second Amendment. So I applaud this. I am all in favor of this. I do want to recognize that it is a resolution. It is a resolution which is words. There's really no teeth. But as best we can, and thank you, Commissioner Ivey, for putting in there at least directional stuff for us in the sense of that we would oppose, and we would oppose in such a way that we'd give some action to it. So I am all in favor of this resolution.
Well, I'm always going to be on the same side as the Constitution and the Bill of Rights. And so I will with this resolution as well. I personally have never put a resolution like this on the agenda, and I don't intend to ever do so. I view it as a political statement. It's not necessarily the conduct of the business of the county. We can't command the state. We can't command the federal government. And I've already taken an oath of office to uphold the Utah Constitution and the Constitution of the United States. I also did so as a member of the state bar. So I'm happy to reaffirm all of those a third time here and to support the Second Amendment. And I do want to point out a couple of things. One, I'll also share one personal experience. There's in this clause, it cites the case McDonald versus the City of Chicago. And what's interesting is that when I was living here in 2008, I decided I wanted to have a handgun. I wanted to protect my family. And I actually also went through the process of I wanted to carry from time to time. I went and got my concealed carry permit, went through the FBI background check and through the gun training to be able to have that permit. And so I felt like I was a pretty responsible gun owner. And then around a little bit later, I moved to Chicago to attend law school. And as I began to review the local ordinances there, there was no legal way for me to transport my handgun into the city of Chicago to have with me in the apartment. And it's interesting because as I was moving there, this case was being argued in front of the Supreme Court. And then 2 months after I got there, the Supreme Court overruled this, upholding the Second Amendment right and overturning that ban on handguns. So I think this is important. There are situations where these rights are being infringed, and we have to stand up and support the Constitution. And then secondly, I just want to point out one other detail here. In this resolution, it opposes unconstitutional restrictions. That's the provision that Commissioner Lee mentioned. It doesn't necessarily oppose all forms of regulation. In fact, it specifically references the Utah Constitution, which reserves to the state legislature the ability to define what the lawful use of arms is and to set reasonable constitutional regulations. And so with that, I'm happy to support this and reaffirm my commitment to the Constitution and to the Second Amendment specifically. Is there
public comment?
Any public comment?
I would like to just make a statement for the record.
Give us your name.
My name is Sean Lorree, SHAWNLOREE. Greetings to all, and I do wish to thank Commissioner Ivey for inviting me to this meeting today. The mainstream media would have you believe that all gun advocates are a bunch of redneck hillbillies. As you can see from my attire, I don't quite fit that stereotype. I'm an educated medical professional with over 34 years of experience treating the sick and injured in this country. I've been a Utah County resident now for over 10 years, having escaped the California restrictions on firearms. There are many arguments that could be made before and against the ownership of private firearms, more than we have time to discuss in this hearing. So I will talk about words, because words do have meaning. So I wish to focus on the words that is the source of all gun rights, and that is, of course, the Second Amendment. We all know what the Second Amendment says because we hear it over and over again by both sides who criticize it daily. There are several words in this amendment which generate the most arguments. The first word, of course, is militia. George Mason, in his address to the Virginia Ratifying Convention in 1788, stated, "I ask, who are the militia?" He said, "They consist of the whole people, except for some public officials." I guess Mr. Mason had a bit of jest. And then, of course, Alexander Hamilton also said in the Federalist Papers, which is the source material which constituted the eventual Constitution, that all able-bodied men and women make up the militia of their respective communities. The militia would be used to defend a neighboring state or community from a common enemy or to guard the republic against the violence of faction or sedition. By its nature, the militia will not be easy for the federal government to abuse and will instead act as a check on tyranny. This also then leads us to the words just before that, which is well-regulated. Many would focus on the word regulation and therefore think of regulations as meaning government laws and regulations which manage private ownership of firearms. However, in the 1700s and 1800s, the word well-regulated, a hyphenated word, simply meant that the tools that were available for the militia were going to be in good working order. And the first people with good working order militias, of course, were, of course, the Minutemen, okay? They had rifles at the ready, and they were ready to defend their country. Then we get to the other big word, and that is the word infringe. And this word has a lot of power, because it defines as actively breaking the terms of the law, or act as so as to limit or undermine or encroach upon the law. This concept, and taken in that context, means that every regulation ever put into the government, state or local, since 1789, is essentially unconstitutional. All existing gun laws undermine or encroach the free possession and use of firearms. Therefore, every gun legislation, of course, is an infringement. Utah has some of the lowest crime rates and the lowest firearm usages in many other states. The last mass shooting event that happened in Utah, of course, was the 2007 Trolley Square incident, where five people were shot. Now, that incident was disarmed or neutralized by an off-duty police officer. Now, of course, in many other states, even off-duty police officers are limited and forbidden from carrying their service weapons. But there was somebody that in Utah had the right to do so. and was able to stop a mass shooter. And of course, we've all seen the recent Texas church shooting that was stopped by a 71-year-old concealed weapon carrier with a lot of experience in firearms, but he was able to stop the event after only two people were hurt. But you all have seen the video where half the other members of the congregation pulled their weapons as well, okay? And so therefore, guns save lives. It is proven over and over again in our society. Millions of firearms are simply drawn in the presence of them will stop and deter crimes. So we need to see more of that and less infringement on that so that we can all be healthy and happy together. I know that this commission are elected officials, and we hope that you make good decisions on our behalf as the constituents of this county. Thank you.
Thank you.
Any other public comment? Okay, I would entertain a motion.
Move that we approve regular agenda item number one.
Second.
We have a motion and a second to approve regular agenda item number one. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. That passes 3-0. Regular agenda item number two.
Hi, this is Ralph Barnes, Human Resources. We had a position come open, the field commander major crimes task force, and as usual, we started the process to replace that position. It was found during that process, the sheriff was already in the process of making the replacement. The sheriff and I were notified that there was a resolution back in 2012 that role was not to be replaced when it was vacated. That was the intent of the commission then, 2012. Of course, the sheriff and I weren't here at that time, and we're not aware of that. At that time, Human Resources placed the recruitment on hold, pending an opportunity for the sheriff, to make the case for why he needed to replace that position. And really at this point, because it's been 8 years and it's hard to say that things are the same now as they were then, I think the sheriff is asking to replace this because of changes in his office and the needs that they have at this time. The lieutenant role that he's asking to replace, you could say the funding is already existing in the staffing plan, but if you consider the resolution, it was intended to be actually taken out at this time. So that's why it's here for you to look at and make a determination if that's something you want to fund going forward. At this point, I guess I'd like to ask someone from the sheriff's office to explain the case for why this is needed at this time.
Okay. I mean, I'll just make one comment as well that I've spoken to the sheriff. I'm aware that this was supposed to be taken out of the staffing plan. However, from my perspective this year, Sheriff Smith is still making a lot of changes in his department, trying to make sure that they're staffed appropriately. Also, there were a number of requests for positions that were not given to the sheriff's department, and as a result, the conversations that I've had with Sheriff Smith are giving him more flexibility to move around positions as he tries to make do with a certain dollar amount in that budget. And so I think that's the commitment that I've received from the Sheriff's Department. And so I don't see moving or approving one staffing plan as a significant change at all, because they're still capped at the same dollar amount, regardless of how that's allocated. So that's just my perspective on this position.
Okay, thank you. Matt Higley, I'm Chief Deputy with the Sheriff's Office. Sheriff Smith apologizes that he couldn't be here today. I think what I'd like to do is read a little bit of a memo that I believe he sent to you three commissioners. I would just like to read a little bit of this. Sheriff Smith says, "As sheriff, there is no greater importance to me than the safety and wellness of my deputies. Deputies are routinely exposed to stressful, demanding incidences that challenge them both physically and mentally. The health and wellness of public safety employees have become a topic on a national level. The focus of these concerns is highlighted by 2019 statistics showing nearly five times as many police officers killed themselves than were feloniously killed. With 2020 statistics already well on their way to match or exceed. To add to the stress of the job, mainstream media portrays a widespread war on officers fueled by a loud minority using any means to communicate discontent and hatred toward law enforcement and government entities. We are fortunate to live and work in a state where most media outlets don't fall into the mainstream national influence. However, the sheriff's office has felt this effect on numerous instances. One of the causes is due to a lack of communication from the sheriff's office in educating the public to the tremendous good done by individual deputies daily. This relationship must be nurtured with the public to gain their trust. Due to cell phones, social media, and the speed of information dissemination, the days of no comment are no longer an option. The role of the public information officer, or PIO, has been based on reactive information and in giving strict facts. This limits the ability to be proactive with social media and provide a broader education to the public. The sheriff has a responsibility to address these issues. This proposed position will address these issues in two ways. First and foremost, a deputy wellness program will be implemented and a proactive educational approach of the sheriff's office will be provided through multiple social media channels. The sheriff's office believes each person we deal with is a human being and deserves to be treated with respect and dignity. In turn, the sheriff's office wants the public to understand that our deputies are human beings as well. This position will begin the process of bringing the public to the sheriff's office and the sheriff's office to the public through social media and education. The idea behind, hopefully I'm not mistaken, was when that major crimes position shifted and came back to the sheriff's office recently, and Sheriff Smith has tried to figure out a way where he could bring a mental health or an employee wellness program specifically to the sheriff's office. And along with that, provide some very specific training and then create a better public information dissemination from the sheriff's office to the public. Because we really do have some great things going on and we really stink at getting that information out to the public. And the idea was, let's create this position so that we can better ourselves, which in turn betters the community. I think a couple other things I wanted to share. Some of the goals of this position is not only to help our staff, but you know, we put on a teacher's academy this past year, and it was extremely successful. This position would also oversee that. Sheriff Smith has started an honorary colonel's program. It will oversee that. And as well as teach de-escalation tactics and mindfulness training to deputies and other staff as well. It'll also provide some peer support things. It's kind of new for law enforcement, but I think it's the right direction to go, and it will be a benefit not only to staff, but to the public in general as well.
I'll just say, Sean Chipman, Sheriff's Office. You know, this just as a side note, it's really not coming from Sheriff Smith, but from me. He spoke about this type of as a campaign promise, as he ran on this, that he wanted to improve the relationship between the sheriff's office, law enforcement, and the public. And I really feel like this is a very good way to get this done with this position and without costing us any money, without asking for additional monies. And I just feel like, you know, it's a really efficient way to get where he wants to go with his department.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So I have a different take, and it has nothing to do with kind of the goals and the what they're trying to accomplish in the sheriff's department. It has to do with process and looking back at in 2012 when the commissioners put this forward. They put this forward, and through reading their notes and the minutes with it, I can see that they deliberately put it in place so that when this position goes away, it doesn't come back into the sheriff's department, which I hear comes back into the sheriff's department. It doesn't. It's gone. So the funding's gone. There's technically no funding for it. It is an addition. And as I look at that, I wonder why they would be so rigid with it, because their words seem pretty rigid with it. They're at over and over. Why? No, this one, it's gone. It's gone. So does everyone understand? Does the sheriff know? Does he write now? This one, when it goes away, it goes away. The sheriff at the time. And so I have to question why they're doing that. The only reason that I can look is that this position with Major Crimes Task Force, it rotates. It rotates around. It'll come back again. It'll come back to the sheriff's department once again, and then what will happen is that it'll be funded again, and so I think part of their reasoning was that as it rotates around, it's a position that's funded for a period of time, then goes away, and then when it comes back around, the funding goes in there again and goes away. It has nothing to do with what the sheriff's trying to accomplish with a new PIO. He does have there is a PIO there now. I can see that this is a bigger task than what Spencer Cannon does right now, and so I can see the needs there, but I'm concerned on multiple levels. I know at the end of last year we were looking at a vehicle for this, and I was accused over and over of saying no, we're not going to do this because basically this position goes away, and I didn't sign off on that vehicle, and because there was no money for it, and so. I will be voting no on it. I don't know. It sounds like the commission might go differently with it, but I just wanted to be noted that that was the intent. The intent was, for this position to go away, as it will rotate back around again.
Okay. And understand your position, but I know that Sheriff Smith, one of the things in the funding part of the memo we sent was, back in 2009, just after the recession and the big budget cuts, we did lose two lieutenant positions that we never did get back. And so we've really ran short administratively in that realm. And again, if we had those, we could probably make some in-house type moves, but we don't. And I just fall back to, this is something very important to the sheriff. He has promised constituents that he would, build those bridges with the community. And this is again, in my opinion, a really good way to accomplish that. So
one comment I want to make is, I do see this, I think, differently than it's been communicated. It even sounds, in some case, your presentation, you're trying to justify it as if it's a new request. Commissioner Lee is kind of framing it like that. Again, for me, this is a decision that Sheriff Smith is making. He has agreed, the budget has already been approved of a certain wage level that's in the sheriff's budget. And so this, in my view, I don't view this about anything to do about a staffing plan or a position that should go away or not. Because the sheriff could modify this staffing plan five times in the next 5 months. And the point I'm making, though, is the sheriff's department is making a decision that this is the use of dollars that is more important than an additional deputy in the jail or an additional deputy in enforcement. And so I'm going to respect what Sheriff Smith's decision is on that, within the budget that has already been approved of how he's going to prioritize that. And so I don't see this as, this vote today does not give any new wage funding to the sheriff's budget.
No, it does. I think Ralph even mentioned, even though it was funded last year, it was funded on the basis of what was intact at the time. But as soon as that Major Crimes Task Force position goes away, that funding mechanism goes away.
Well, it's but not, so I don't. Here's why I disagree with that is, well, and maybe we should ask Dave or Josh, but we've got two different things. We have something that was passed a long time ago that said that at this point in time, that position should go away, which I agree. That's what it says. If we were to follow that, then that position goes away. But then we have a budget that we passed a few months ago, right? And that has the wages that's in the Sheriff's Department. I don't think that resolution that was passed in 2009 has the ability to pull out funding from wages from the Sheriff's Department's budget. We can do that.
Well, we do the same thing when we look at grants, you know, grant-funded positions. We put it in the budget for the entire year of the grant-funded position. But if the grant goes away, the funding goes away and the position goes away. And so it's not uncommon to see that happen within a budgeting process.
We certainly could choose to take that money out. I don't know if there's comments down here on the bench, but I'm just saying I don't think that resolution from 2009 automatically pulls the funding out of the Sheriff's Department.
Great. And for me on this one, it's you have your salaried budget, and if you want to have five officers working at the Sheriff's Department for that, that's, you know, I mean, I'm going to support the sheriff in crafting his positions how he sees best to administrate his office. My responsibility on it is the budgetary side. So as long as you're working within your budgeted amount for the fiscal year of 2020 and moving forward, then I'm going to be happy to support the sheriff in staffing his office how he sees is going to provide the greatest amount of protection to the people of this county. And so that's where I'm at with this one.
And the sheriff even signed a document that stated that the position,
Sheriff Tracy,
yeah, the position and the funding goes away.
And so, I want to say that I appreciate that. I mean, it sounded like I'm disagreeing, but it's just because I'm thinking about the Sheriff's Department this year as a cap amount. But I'm glad that you're following up on this, because when we pass a position like this, we should hold them accountable to the restraints. And so I'm noting that and just feeling like sheriff can make his decision now, but we should absolutely make sure that we follow up on these types of resolutions.
Thank you.
It's nice to see the civility of you gentlemen. Mark Allen from Protect and Preserve American Fort Canyon. I sit on a committee at the request of the Forest Service, and the times are different than in 2012 when they may have done away with that position. This last week in our meeting, we talked about the drug deals that are starting to go up Canyon. We've got cell towers that are going to be being put in up American Fort Canyon. It's going to engender city problems to move up the canyon with more frequency and ability to connect and say, hey, meet me up at this place, and more problems are going to happen up the canyon. So I strongly support whatever funding requests the sheriff's office has, even above and beyond what you have allocated for this year. I listened to the discussion when David Levitt was asking for funding for 13 more attorneys. And I believe, Tanner, you were the one that were being judicially responsible and said, wait a minute, that's going to be an expansion of our the future budget. So I think we're singing the same song here, just as a second verse. And so to your position, Commissioner Lee, I would say if we just look back into November discussions where we were actually expanding the budgetary process for prosecutors, we have. I don't see any reason why we would want to restrict the sheriff's office in the same manner. It seems duplicitous to me to do anything to restrict them. So even if they do need to have an expanse, to be proactive. And I appreciated the heat that you gentlemen took. It's the price of a pizza for the services that you're asking for. I think the real problem we have is with the school districts. And just a side note on how we could fix all of these problems really quick and take the heat off of you. The education infrastructure build-out is the problem. My daughter does online school. I get metrics every day, how many minutes that she spent. If we'd go to a every other day school model, You wouldn't have your budget problems. You wouldn't be collecting the heat. We could double the capacity of our physical education infrastructure right now and save $500 million a year. It's not rocket science to do it, but it is disruptive. You wouldn't have to struggle and fight to pay the sheriff's office. They could be well-staffed instead of understaffed. So anyway, just a comment. I think one of the things that we're looking to do with our canyon projects, with the yurt specifically, the first yurt that I want to put in up American Fork Canyon is for the sheriff's office. Search and rescue, a respite for they can go and have a little bit of downtime with their family and decompress from all the crap that they have to get experienced. I can't comprehend to the level that they have, but I have in the last 2 years experienced some tremendous emotional burdens and duress that some of you know of, and I won't go into that here. But everybody needs a place to decompress. Liberty and justice is important. Funding the sheriff's office appropriately will allow for that. But we're not in 2012, and the problems that are coming at our society are going to just increase. So I hope I'm never in another meeting where we try and hold back the request from what the sheriff needs so that he can protect me and my family and the community. I think that should be the top line item. So anyway, with that, thank you. Hope to work with you further on the yurt stuff. It passed the House yesterday, 13-1. Now it moves towards the Senate. And then I may not be here when you talk about item 38 with the surveyor. I'd strongly support getting the surveyor the tools that he needs, the personnel that he needs, because I am here as a representative of American Fork Canyon Alliance as well. I want to pay my taxes on my half acre in American Fork Canyon, and I've begged for 4 years. So use my little small amount of taxes, allocate it specifically towards the Sheriff's Department. It may be $7 a year, but we want to make our contribution. Thanks.
Thank you. Okay. Based on what I've heard, it sounds like we need item number 5 and item number 7.
We need to we take action on number 2, though.
Okay. Sorry, I'll entertain a motion on number 2.
I'll move that we authorize the addition as stated in regular agenda item number 2.
Second.
We have a motion and a second to approve item number 2. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed?
Aye.
That passes 2-1 with Commissioner Ainge, Commissioner Ivey for, and Commissioner Lee against. Okay. I think we need 5 and 7 is all.
Yep. All right. I'll move that we strike regular agenda items number 6 and 8.
Second.
We have a motion and second to strike number 6 and 8. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. That passes 3-0.
Move that we approve and set a date, time, and location for the closed meetings as described in regular agenda items numbers 5 and 7 for today's date immediately following the completion of regular business.
Second.
We have a motion and a second to hold the closed meetings as discussed for numbers 5 and 7. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. That passes 3-0. We have no work session. Is there any additional public comment? Seeing none, we'll now move into our closed session.
Wants to
have that submitted to it.
Have that submitted so that people can see the reference both articles. That's, or their response to that article.
Definitely fair enough. So he can just submit that, and he'll just go on the minutes.
Yeah.
Okay.
Dave, can we close even though he hasn't? Can we just say we're allowing him to do that and close?
For the record.
No, end the meeting, I meant.
Yeah, part of the minutes of this meeting.
Yeah. Okay. So for the record, we are going to allow the clerk auditor's office to submit their official response from their applicant vendor to the MIT report.
Okay.
Motion to adjourn.
Second.
We have a motion and second to adjourn. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. We're now adjourned.